Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a 5-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. Well, happy Sunday, everyone. November 20th, 2022. This is Chase, as always, joined by Nick. Nick, how are you doing?
Doing great, Chase. Great to be back on before the break and before the team goes to the Bahamas here. And definitely, I think we got a fun episode ahead of us here.
Yeah. So much to talk about. We're broadcasting just as the UCLA game, basketball game, ended. So tough week in Westwood. They lose the first part of this mini tournament in Vegas, which I have to say, I mean, I think a lot of their fans rightfully objected to the timing of this because the games are scheduled on Friday and Sunday, bookending the USC-UCLA game at the Rose Bowl. So they lose to Illinois to start this thing, a comeback loss. Illinois came back, then the game yesterday, which we're going to talk about, and then they lose to Baylor today. So it was a rough weekend, but look, rough weekends happen. Teams bounce back. Big game that we're talking about first is the football game, the meat of that sandwich. So you predicted USC was going to win it. I was skeptical. I think up until the very last minute of that game, we each had our arguments that we were, on how it was going to come out. USC somehow pulls this out. The offense was really great. And other than one, mental mistakes at the beginning of the game, and then that one mistake that Caleb made late in the game where he decided to throw the ball the last second instead of just running it, we played really amazing game. Caleb was phenomenal. But UCLA was tough too, and the defense, it stepped up when it needed to and forced four turnovers, but it wasn't otherwise really stopping UCLA too much. So anyway, what are your takeaways from the game, and now SC being effectively two games away from a potential college football playoff berth?
Yeah, it's a crazy game. I think, USC is just so lucky to have Caleb Williams. He's just so good. I think in terms of USC players, he's the best that the team's had since Reggie Bush. I mean, I can't think of a, more impactful, at least on their team, player on their team as Caleb is. His mobility just shines through. He's really hard to sack because he can just escape. His throwing ability both from the pocket and on the run is just ridiculous. So we'll see if he can position himself for the Heisman. I think the Notre Dame game will be key for that, but he's phenomenal. Made two mistakes all game, really. Just the play you mentioned at the end where he should have ran, he kind of had a mental brain fart and just threw a laser to follow that was incomplete, and the pick where he didn't see the guy in coverage in the first quarter. But I thought the defense wasn't great. They kind of got unlucky early, right, where they had these really huge plays that didn't go their way. The fourth down, well, first of all, Relique Brown giving up the first down to run backwards, then them missing the fourth and one, and then them missing two more field goals in that first half. I think just, it seemed like, everything was going UCLA's way. They were able to gut it out. They're two wins away from the playoff now. So, regardless of what happens these next few weeks, I think both will be hard games. You just have to feel really good about where the season's at right now.
Yeah. And gosh, there's so much to say about what happened last night, where we're going. DTR for UCLA. SC won't have to face him again. We've had success and difficulties against him at various times. Kind of remarkable that it seemed like he really injured his fingers, his hand, throwing hand, in the third quarter of the game yesterday, and we really weren't able to take advantage of that maybe until the very end of the game. UCLA kind of just marched down the field at moments where any stop and try and take advantage of that injury would have helped, and we couldn't really get that done. That's something obviously to look for the future, trying to see what we do with personnel. And you know, I don't know if maybe we're, you know, the schemes are a little bit too tricky and we're trying to do too much. It's, you know, it certainly appears to me that way sometimes. But look, we're there. Notre Dame is an interesting team. They have, on the season, played Ohio State very tough, beaten Clemson, their only loss of the season, rather decisively. Up until yesterday, North Carolina's only loss was to Notre Dame. And at the same time, they struggled with Cal, lost to Stanford, struggled with Navy, lost to Marshall. So very kind of like schizophrenic team. You know, it's theoretically possible that Notre Dame would even face three college football playoff teams. It's theoretically possible. I don't think that's going to happen. Yeah. But but the line is only 4.5 as of this morning, I think. I'm not sure if there's been any movement on that. That's a rather kind of, you know, small line for SC playing at home, being 10-1. But, you know, I think that's not surprising given the state the defense has been in. I guess the one thing about this game, if we don't have a chance to podcast again before we play it, you know, the SC has played some tough quarterbacks this year, DTR and Rising for Utah, and the Fresno State quarterback who got hurt in that game, and a few others. Notre Dame doesn't really have a super dynamic offense, so you know, it's going to be an opportunity for our defense to step up a bit, I think. Try to demonstrate they deserve to be in this conversation for the college football playoff. The offense is, you know, the Notre Dame defense is going to be tougher than the defenses SC has played recently. So, but SC, you know, Utah's got a stellar defense and SC scored on them. So SC has proved they can score on tough defenses as well.
Yeah. And Navy, who I believe is 4-7, they just dropped 32 on Notre Dame 2 weeks ago. Then again, Notre Dame did come back last week and beat Boston College 44-0. One thing I will comment on too, like, Notre Dame does have the best tight end in the country in Michael Mayer. He's going to go very high in the draft. He's better than Dalton Kincaid at Utah. And Kincaid just ate USC alive. So that's going to be a big problem, I think, for the defense. We just don't have the personnel to match up with them. Then again, you know, besides him, there aren't too many threats, and Notre Dame's quarterback doesn't have the greatest arm. So the line is up to 5.5 now. So I guess SC has been getting some money in from this morning. Kind of feels right to me. Like, I think SC is definitely the favorite, but it's by no means a game that I think is going to be a blowout.
Yeah. I guess we cover a couple other games from yesterday. There was very close games where the favorite had to win with field goals at the end, both in the case of TCU beating Baylor and Michigan beating Illinois. Michigan Illinois was kind of more straightforward. There was a lot of really odd coaching decisions made in that TCU Baylor game, and this was pointed out on social media. But you know, TCU elected on third down in Baylor territory to do a running play and let the clock run out essentially, and then ran there with a running clock, ran their field goal unit onto the team. And to counter that, Baylor only ran one player onto the field to they didn't do a full like shift change. They didn't bring in a whole field goal block team. If they had done that, I think the officials would have had to stop play for allow that substitution to happen. And the time would have run out, but there was just, it was like, Baylor was just totally unprepared for that contingency. It was a very weird situation. And not to mention that Baylor had played kind of just this very soft defense leading up to that. So I wasn't particularly impressed with Aranda. And they also, in their one series, ran two very conservative run plays and then ran this bootleg, and the quarterback actually decided to run the ball rather than throw to a wide open receiver. So anyway, TCU made it out, credit to them, but I mean, it really took a lot of poor choices, poor decision-making by Baylor for that to happen. I think if TCU would have lost, I don't think they would have been in the conversation for the playoff any longer, likely. We should also mention that Oregon pulled it off against Utah last night in the late game, Pac-12 after dark. Clearly, Nick's was banged up still. He's playing kind of on one foot. And Utah really didn't take super advantage of that. As a result, Oregon looked kind of pedestrian on offense, and it was a lot of non-conversions by Utah. So, I don't know, any thoughts on those games?
Yeah, I thought Rising just didn't play well. I mean, he missed a lot of throws that he usually makes, and the opportunity was there for Utah to take that game, and they just didn't do it. I think that's kind of my bottom line there.
Yeah, and it sets up this very weird, all these like tiebreaker options if Oregon were to lose to Oregon State next week. Now, if Oregon wins, they're in the Pac-12 championship game against USC. USC is then that doesn't the Notre Dame game's obviously out of conference, so that doesn't affect that game. But if Nick's is still banged up, I could definitely see Oregon State winning that game. I mean, Oregon State winning the game even if Nick's is not banged up. But if Oregon State were to win, it sets up a very strange kind of a series of tiebreakers, and I think Utah would actually be in the best position to then still make it in.
Right.
I think Washington, apparently, now I'm going by John Wilner here, but Washington to make it in would need not only Oregon State to lose, but Oregon State to beat Oregon, but they would need UCLA to lose to Cal on Friday, which is possible, but I think less likely. Otherwise, obviously, if Utah were to lose to Colorado, that would not call Utah, but I don't think anyone in the world thinks that's going to happen. So I don't know. Right now, as we sit here today, who do you think USC will be playing in the Pac-12 championship game?
I'll take Oregon. Don't feel great about it, but they just have the most straightforward path of just winning and getting in. That Civil War game in Corvallis seems like a toss-up, and I think Oregon's laying 3.5 there, but especially if Nick's is beat up, I could definitely see them losing. After that, I think you got to go with Utah just because that Colorado game is pretty much a bye game, and all they need is just the Oregon loss. And but I wouldn't totally rule out UCLA losing to Cal, actually. It's on the road, and they're coming off this emotional loss against their rival. And, maybe a lot of their seniors are like, okay, what's there to play for? It's on a Friday night. There's some warning signs there. But I guess, like, as of right now, I think you've got to say Oregon.
Yeah, I agree with that. Just for the record, I guess it's not even called the Civil War any longer because of Dennis Dixon. He stepped in. That's too offensive.
What a shame.
Yeah. So now I'm sure people all around the country will now know this game by a different name. It's a 12:30 local start on the Pacific Coast, 3:30 on the East Coast, which really it's going to be a good game. It'll be interesting. I think it'll be a slugfest, and I would not be surprised if Oregon State pulled it out, but we will see on that one. Okay. That's football for now. I guess before we leave football, we could tell, who do you think is going to win, Ohio State, Michigan? Do you see, I know we'll have time to talk about this, but do you see any scenario where LSU might be able to knock off Georgia in the SEC title game? And what about Clemson? Any chance South Carolina, coming off that big win against Tennessee, gives Clemson a run for it?
Yeah, I think LSU does have a shot against Georgia. I don't think it's a great one. I think Georgia's better, but LSU's got enough talent and speed, I think, to match up with them, and they do have that win against Bama as well. Clemson, South Carolina, I would pick Clemson. I think they just, too much talent on their D, and South Carolina, it kind of feels like they sold out for their season against Tennessee a little bit, and Rattler was hitting everything, and coming into that game, he had 8 TDs and 9 picks, so kind of had a career game out of nowhere. But yeah, if they like beat Clemson, I think that wouldn't be totally shocking. Clemson's shown some vulnerability this year, for sure. I guess that the chaos scenario, right, is what do you do if LSU beats Georgia and TCU doesn't lose, right? So then you've got A one loss non-champ Georgia. Ohio State, Michigan, presumably the winner will be an undefeated Big Ten champ. And an undefeated TCU, right? And a one loss USC and a two loss LSU is the SEC champ, right? So I think in that scenario, TCU and the Ohio State Michigan winner would be undefeated. They'd both be in. And then you would have two spots for a one loss Georgia non-champ, a one loss USC champ, and a two loss LSU SEC champ. Any thoughts on that kind of random scenario?
Well, it would be absolute chaos. I think we, and we haven't even thrown in Clemson to the mix. What happens if Clemson looks
Right.
absolutely dynamic? I
Yep.
think we're going to have to see how these, how, what the margins look like. I mean, I think LSU has already locked up the West, right? So
Right.
there's a
Yep.
scenario where LSU could lose to Texas A&M. And still, and then they
Yeah.
play Georgia and beat them. I mean,
Yeah,
it's
right.
kind of makes you crazy to think about all the scenarios. I don't know. Obviously, LSU is ranked very highly in the rankings right now in the college football playoff rankings.
Yep.
Which, if they beat Georgia, I think would almost ensure they'd be top four. Georgia is like as strong of a number one as you're going to see. Although, Ohio State, I guess, could be nipping at their buds, or Michigan could be nipping at their buds, but you don't necessarily see Georgia falling that far, given the performance this season and how much the margins of victory they've had in many of the games, including against like Oregon to start the season. By the same token, they never played Alabama, and
It's
they've.
kind of a weaker resume than you'd think for Georgia, right?
Yeah, it's
Like,
weird because, right, they didn't play. They did beat, the big win is against Tennessee, right? And Tennessee, I think, was, for the moment, was ranked number one in the college football playoff rankings. They won that game really kind of decisively. But other than that, you have the big, huge win against Oregon. But for example, Tennessee just struggled with South Carolina, and Georgia beat them by 41 points, in Columbia.
yep.
So, and they beat Florida by 22. Now, the Florida's great, but they've really taken care of business all season. They will have now had the opportunity to beat LSU, so they will have beaten most of the best teams. They didn't play Ole Miss, they didn't play Alabama, which is worth thinking about. Yeah, it's an interesting dilemma, but yeah, they did. It is interesting that in the regular, that Georgia in their regular season, while they took on Oregon, but it basically a equivalent of a home game, they were able to miss the top three teams in the West in scheduling. So similar to SC, didn't have to play Oregon or Washington in the North. So anyway, to answer your question, is I'm gonna pump that question because
Yeah.
I think SC would be in a bad spot at that point. But it's such a chaotic scenario, it's hard to tell. And again, I would not be shocked if like LSU dropped a game to Texas A&M. There's all kinds of weird stuff that happens at this point in the season.
Yeah, I think one thing I've seen online, which I think is a pretty ridiculous take, is that the loser of the Ohio State Michigan game would get in over USC as a non-division champ. I think that's pretty outrageous, actually.
Well, the only one I think that even have a chance would be Ohio State, right? Because Michigan, I think it's been confirmed, Michigan had the easiest out of conference schedule of any power conference team. Number one, number two is UCLA, by the way. So I think it'd be hard to reward Michigan under those circumstances. The Big Ten, I don't think, is like strong enough to justify that kind of, leapfrogging a conference winner. And I don't think you'd see that. Now, if Ohio State were to lose, it gets a little more interesting. Obviously, Ohio State beat Notre Dame. Of course, this is all assuming that SC will have beaten not only Notre Dame, but also, I know, Oregon or whoever Utah, a weakened Utah team. I mean, obviously at this point, SC really should be rooting for Oregon, I think, just because they'll really enhance the resume. So I don't think that's a likely scenario when you're dealing with a conference champion versus non-conference champion. And I don't necessarily think that Ohio State has like necessarily. Michigan definitely, I don't think, has done enough this year to warrant, you know, said like, you know, maintaining their, you know, their status. I mean, they have that really juicy win against Penn State, but that's it. I mean, that's really the best thing on they got going on their schedule. Ohio State also has a nice win against Penn State. You know, they had that Notre Dame game win. So I don't know. Those are my thoughts. I don't think that's likely, but if it's going to happen, much, much more likely with Ohio State. I just, with Michigan, I can't even imagine it.
You know, to me, just looking at it, right, like you look at that Notre Dame home win, in that case, right, USC would also have a Notre Dame home win. Because if USC loses Notre Dame, it's not even a conversation, right? So USC yeah. would match that Notre Dame home win. That would effectively cancel out. And then you're looking at their resume, which is a home loss to Michigan, which yep. I think is about equivalent to a road loss to Utah, you know, in my mind. And then you've got, you know, their last piece is at Penn State. USC would have at UCLA, which is pretty close to that. But then they would also have, you know, Oregon neutral in this case, plus the conference title designation. I just don't see it. You know, then again, like crazier things have happened. Ohio State has the brand in the East Coast and kind of the Big Ten bias and that cachet. But it'll be somewhat telling, you know, if USC beats Notre Dame and Ohio State loses to Michigan, we're going to get a college football playoff ranking. And at that point, if USC is ahead of Ohio State, it's not even a conversation. If USC is one spot behind Ohio State, then it is a little more interesting, right? Then USC would have to jump one spot with the conference championship win. I think the committee might just punt it and put USC ahead of them initially, so there's not like this heated debate after the conference championship season. But we'll see. I mean, lots of interesting scenarios. I just think that Ohio State team is kind of fraudulent.
That's, you know, yeah. And the, one of the weird things about the Big Ten this year is you have a lot of teams in kind of this, you know, other than after Penn State as a third place team and overall, you know, you don't have anyone with a better record than 7-4. And then you've got, several of those. Right. So you don't, you know.
I didn't even mention the Oregon State win either, right? Like USC has that at Oregon State, which is probably going to be in the top 20 this week. So,
right. So, no, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's move over to basketball. Yep. I guess let's talk about USC basketball first. Let's do it reverse. Let's talk about some of the games we've seen over the last several days nationally. We talked about UCLA a little bit. They ended up losing both of their games in Vegas. Unfortunate scheduling, because if you were a UCLA sports fan and you wanted to go to the big football game, you were not going to make the trip to Vegas and then come back and then go back. The crowd for that UCLA Baylor game that just finished was pretty quiet. I think most of the people there were there for Illinois and maybe some for Virginia. They weren't there for Baylor, it doesn't seem like, or UCLA, which is unfortunate because the game was in Vegas. The game against Illinois, UCLA was getting almost all of its scoring, like I think close to 88% of its scoring from those key pieces of Tiger Campbell, Jaime Jaquez, and David Singleton, who Mick Cronin inherited from Steve Alford. Jalen Clark, who had been the leading scorer before that, obviously didn't really show up for the game against Illinois scoring-wise, but he did come back and have a nice game today scoring-wise against Baylor, but they still lost. So meanwhile, while UCLA did a much better job scoring today against Baylor, the defense struggled more. You did get a little bit of scoring from Dylan Andrews, which is interesting. So maybe he's stepping up a bit. And then, you know, like I mentioned, Jalen Clark had 23 points. So, you know, it's kind of important, I guess, for UCLA to get like that big production from Clark, because they can't just rely on Hawkins, Campbell, and Singleton all season long. Meanwhile, the two, you know, top 10 recruits, Bona and Bailey, combined for just 7 points. didn't do a ton. Bonus kind of struggling against higher level competition. I think Bailey's finding that the Mikrona offense is not really suited for him at this point. He's got to develop his half court shot making ability. On the other side of the ball, just to talk about Baylor for a second, Keontae George really struggled himself at the end of the day. It was Cryer and Flagler, you know, the upperclassmen leading the way for Baylor. Although I have to say the Baylor bigs, like Flo Thamba, were tougher at the rim. And, you know, you could see a difference there. Overall, Baylor won a narrow rebounding, had a narrow rebounding edge. UCLA actually shot better from the field, did not shoot well from three, probably the reason they lost. Both Cryer and Flagler were 4-for-8 from three. Anyway, what are your thoughts at UCLA after these two games in Vegas?
Kind of my key takeaway here is just if you're not a shot-making guard, you're just going to struggle in Cronin's system. You know, he just doesn't run enough action and offense to get, you know, these guys into the perfect spots. And I think that's why, you know, you're sensing the losses of Juzang and Bernard are just bigger than I think you might have anticipated. Like, I think a lot of UCLA fans thought, oh, you can just plug in Amari Bailey, a top 10 recruit, and, you know, you won't miss a beat. But those guys were such key pieces, and they were, you know, I think Bernard was a pretty good defender too. Juzang was kind of mediocre, but they have value. Like, those pieces had a lot of value. And even with David Singleton starting the year 15 for 27 for three, which is a ridiculous percentage, they're still 3-2 kind of after all this. So it does make you wonder too, like, if you're a freshman, like, why would you go to, if you're a one and done player, why would you go to UCLA?
Is there, yeah, no, I think this is going to be, I think this is going to put a lid on, look, they're already struggling, obviously recruiting that type of player. To the extent that, like, Andre Stojakovic thought he might be one and done player.
Right.
He decided not to go to UCLA. Certainly Isaiah Collier, Ron Holland decided not to go. So yeah, I think that is a struggle for them. And I can say that probably if I was Mick Cronin, I would not be expecting that type of player going forward. That being said, you don't need in Mick Cronin's system to have one and dones, but you do need to develop the right players. And he inherited like perfect players for his offense. And I'm not sure how much of that's been appreciated. And I don't know how much he appreciates what David Singleton's done and given him kind of unexpected scoring in moments they really needed it. If Singleton was not around for these two games, UCLA would have lost by quite a bit more. Just, you know, something to think about for them. And, you know, Tiger has not been shooting lights out. He did not shoot lights out from three of these two games. And yeah, that affects, you know, obviously Hawk Hez has not really regained his 3-point shooting form. So they're going to struggle from three, and they need Singleton out there hitting the threes. And, because not a lot of other players are going to be doing it. So,
yeah. And one other thing too, like Jalen Clark, you know, we've made the point on here, he struggled against good competition in the past. He was great against Baylor today. Like, he was legitimately really good. And, you know, on the season, he's now up to 15 points a game, 8 boards, 3 assists, and 3.5 steals. And he's done that while keeping his foul rate low. Like, he's only averaging 2.5 fouls per 40 per game and playing 28 minutes a game. So he's been spectacular, I think, for them. And Singleton has. And for the most part, they're upperclassmen and delivered. And it just makes you wonder about next year. Like, let's say Jalen Clark goes pro.
Well, that would be a disaster.
Right.
I mean,
you lose Hawkes.
Right. Well, now you're wondering who's more likely
Singleton
to go.
I mean,
who's more lucky? Well, Singleton's gone, right? He's out of eligibility.
He's not gone. Yep.
At this point, like, who's more likely to go pro after this season, Jalen Clark or Amari Bailey? You know, and if you're coming back next year, and gosh, if your team is Dylan Andrews, Amari Bailey, and then, you know, some combination, I guess Will McClendon. I'm not sure where they're going to have to get some transfers to fill in the, and I know they have that one European player also that could play small forward, but that's a completely different type of UCLA team and a total rebuild for Cronin. So yeah, that's going to be an interesting thing going forward, but you know, programs need to go through the rebuilds. That's kind of been the thing for Cronin. He's never had to rebuild, right? He's had that core of Campbell and Hawkins, and to an extent, Singleton every year since he arrived. He's had those players on the team. So, okay, let's talk about a couple other, in the other game. Oh, by the way, what do you think about Baylor's prospects going forward here? I think Baylor played better down the stretch. I think we both agreed there was a moment in the first half where Hawkins had to sit with two fouls, and UCLA used that opportunity to come back from a lead that Baylor had built. Wasn't particularly thrilled about it. I mean, Flagler hit some huge shots down the stretch, which basically is the reason Baylor won. But, George did not look great. I think, these are a lot of these teams are good, but they have serious flaws in them. And I think Baylor can beat most teams, maybe all the teams in the country, but they can lose to their range of losses, I think, is going to be pretty high too.
Yeah. They're just going to be dependent on shooting night in, night out. And most of those nights they're going to win just because Cryer and Flagler are such lethal shot makers. And George has had the reputation of being a pretty lethal shot maker for a freshman guard. Obviously he was horrific against UCLA. Going 2 for 10 with 4 turnovers, but you have to imagine he'll mean regress and make more shots going forward. So I think they'll be fine. Like I don't think they're gonna win the national title or anything like that. But I think it is such an advantage having a guard like Flagler, who like late in that game, they didn't really know what they were doing, and he just crossed up Hawkins and buried like a jumper in his face, right? I mean, that's just not many teams have a guy who can do that like late clock. So I think they'll be okay, but I think Texas, for instance, is better, right, at this point.
Yeah. I guess we should mention the reemergence of Tony Bennett in Virginia after a couple of snoozing years. And Reese Beekman have a huge game today. They beat Baylor, who won today, and they beat Illinois, who beat UCLA. So they were the class of the tournament. They won both games fairly comfortably. They're going to always play that terrific defense. The numbers don't pop out at you, but they just get it done. And they still have Kihei Clark there, point guard. I don't know. Are they now potentially the favorites over North Carolina in the ACC?
There's a pretty good case for it. Their experience, they really defend. I mean, Beekman's just a menace on the defensive end, and they've got enough shot making there. I mean, with Franklin and Clark, and Beekman's not a great shooter, but he's passable, and they're just tough. I mean, they play their pack line, and they've got, Shedrick at the back end of it. He's really improved every year. And Vanderplas even showed a lot of toughness. They're transferred from Ohio, and he's a good player. I mean, he played in tournament games for Ohio, and I think they beat Virginia, actually, ironically enough, a few years ago in the tournament. So, Tony Bennett's team, his program, I think they just lacked talent, and he let his roster get a little bit, he just wasn't pulling in the talent that he needed to over the last few years. But this year, I think there's enough there where you can expect them to be a probably top 4 seed in the tournament, I think, this year.
Yeah, I think top 3 potentially. Franklin, by the way, who's been by far their best player, held the 9 points today. Not great shooting, but they got it done without him having a huge game. Right now, Gonzaga's playing Kentucky, which is, very high. These are number 2 versus number 4. Those rankings are before each team, I think, suffered their losses earlier this week. But Gonzaga's got a 12-point lead in the first half here. I don't know. Is there an argument that Kentucky should be a little worried about things? I know we're really early here, and You know, they it's not like they, you know, gotten blown out by teams, but I do want I really expected them to come out and play Gonzaga really tough here and look like they're struggling. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, they just don't really have the guys that are fitting together right now, it seems like. I mean, like, you know, when you play Sabir Wheeler and Damian Collins and Oscar Tshiebwe together, you know, you're basically begging opposing teams to never leave the paint on defense. You know, they have these lineups where they just don't have the necessary spacing in there offensively. And, you know, Sabir Wheeler can't really shoot. Case and Wallace, like, can kind of shoot. So they're really relying on CJ Frederick, that transfer from Iowa, to make shots and keep, you know, their floor spaced, and Antonio Reeves to a lesser extent. But they've got a lot of kind of weird pieces that I think it's going to take a while to figure out, but definitely a disappointing start for them. They should have beaten Michigan State, right? Like, I think that Michigan State team is like good, but not great. If you're like a legitimate Final Four threat, that's the kind of game you have to win.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think these guys are going to – well, we'll see. I think they will develop over the course of the season, and they'll kind of figure things out a little more. But, yeah, one of the problems you have is it's not clear like a guy like Frederick is truly one of the top five players on the team, but you need to have him out there because you don't – like all the top five guys can't hit jump shots, which is not an ideal situation. You know, we didn't mention Toppin. He was kind of been up and down this year. Tshiebwe is, I guess he's got 10 points in this game, but he was on the court when I was watching. Tonight, Houston, Oregon. I think we both ultimately decided to pick Houston to cover. I think that we did that in the last podcast. So that's later tonight, which if people are listening right as this comes out, that game will probably be going on. Let's move over to, by the way, halftime, Michigan 33, Ohio Bobcats, where my dad went to college, 31. So they're struggling there. And I think I got to find this. Where is
– Do you want to talk about Michigan ASU?
Yeah, let's – all I saw was the stat line. So I just saw the crazy the shooting that ASU put into that game. So why don't you take it and run with it.
It was just an athletic mismatch. I mean, ASU just had way too much length and quickness, and they were blown by Michigan, and Michigan couldn't blow by them on the other end. So they were really relying on just dumping it to Dickinson and having him shoot jump hooks. And he got his, but it wasn't, you know, his normal, like, super efficient self. Because they were throwing, like, Alonzo Gaffney on him, who's this, you know, 6'9 dude with serious length and could body him a bit and just taking away his left hand. So it was actually a really good scout by Bobby Hurley on that end of the floor. Then Michigan, they don't play any defense. Like that Ohio team right there, you can see the warning signs coming, right? Like, they gave up 83 to Eastern Michigan early in the year.
Yeah.
Ohio is 207 in KenPom. So Michigan was a 17-point KenPom favorite in that game. Shouldn't be close, and it is. So you kind of, I think, are seeing the signs of it's similar to Mick Cronin, where Juwan Howard is running. He's run out of John Beilein's players. Cronin's about to run out of Steve Alford's players. And I think Mick is a much better coach than Juwan Howard. So I don't want to, you know, go too far with it, but if you're a Michigan fan, I think you have to be extremely concerned about kind of where this thing is heading under Juwan Howard.
Yep. No, I think that's right. And I think Michigan is potentially going through a lot of the pains SC is going through right now, because it's not clear that they really have the personnel to warrant with their ranking. Obviously, you know, when you have one like all American type player who's been there forever and will be there forever, you think, oh, well, that could be the basis for everything what you do, but it's not clear that they have the pieces around them, even Juwan's son Jet. So I'm pretty skeptical of Michigan going forward, especially the Big Ten looks pretty tough this year. You know, Illinois, you know, notwithstanding today's game, looked pretty tough. I think I'm not sure Michigan. Remember, Michigan really only barely got into the tournament last year. I would not be surprised if they only barely get, they don't make it this year.
Yep.
Okay, well, let's talk about USC basketball, which is the topic of what this podcast is supposed to be. SC won again, ugly fashion against Mount St. Mary's. Now, I will say on the positive note here, and obviously Mount St. Mary's is a step down from, let's say, where Vermont is, but not a huge step down. The offense actually, like, guys actually, there's movement. There was like an offense that was discernible, that got guys quality shots. You could see movement, you could see the ball going around. We scored more points as a result. And we didn't need to rely strictly on, Drew Peterson, his post-up game, although he had a 12 assists in the game. So there was movement on the offensive end. We still really struggle with shooting. Now, in the first three games, we basically, the two games where we didn't have high quality looks from the outside, we shot poorly, which is not surprising. Against Alabama State, we had much higher quality looks and we hit them. Last against Mount St. Mary's, though, we had pretty high quality looks from three, and for a lot of the games, we were missing those looks. So that's a little concerning. It took a while for this game to kind of for SC to kind of get control of this game. Another concern. It did not help, I think, that Kajani Wright missed the game because he was sick. So Nyagu played, and he didn't look like he was necessarily ready to be playing right now. Joshua Morgan is the one nice, real surprise on the team, and hopefully he'll be back next year as well. There's little things here and there you can see. Okay, this looks a little better. This looks a little better. Kobe Johnson made a really nice play at the end of the game, to kind of help seal the game when we had faltered and let Mount St. Mary's get a little close. But earlier in the game, when we had him in there, he had some bad turnovers, really didn't, contribute a lot on the offensive end. Trey White actually, I think, played pretty well, and he started the game for Kobe. So I think Kobe is turning more into a specialty player who specializes in defense. I don't think he can have the role that they envision for him. And yeah, it's still a work in progress. And I say that as we're heading to Atlantis for this tournament, which I guess we'll talk about in a second. But before we get to that, any thoughts on the game?
Yeah, it definitely does seem like their top five are emerging, and Coach Enfield did go with that in the starting lineup. So he made that change, and the five are Bogey Ellis, Drew Peterson, Trey White, Josh Morgan, and Reese Dixon Waters. And certainly, like, Reese hasn't played up to his capability this year, but. Yeah, you saw stretches when those five were in the game where they did okay, and yeah, there were some signs of life from the offense. They did generate some decent shots. A lot of it, I think, is just with this faster tempo too. Like, they're just throwing the ball away way too often. I mean, Drew, he had like six turnovers in that game, right? And even though he had like a 2-to-1 assist to turnover ratio and had 12 assists, a lot of those turnovers were kind of unforced. And I think that'll get cleaned up throughout the years as they get more reps, and they are a younger team and they're in a new system. So there are going to be growing pains with that for sure. But you do have kind of the positive signs, especially when they stick with those five. So happy to see that switch. And certainly wasn't a great game. And they moved down in the analytics because they gave up that 10-0 run with 4 minutes left when the game was pretty much in hand already. But was happy to see a lot of the some better flow in the second half there.
Yeah, and just so we can go through some of the numbers, shooting 45% from the field, not terrible. 53 from two, not bad. 30% from three. That's actually that. That hurts. We're holding opponents with 30% from three. We're actually holding opponents under 40% from two, which is good. So we're maintaining field goal defense. Good, although the level of competition is relatively low. The rebounding margin is very tight. We're only out rebounding teams by two per game. A bigger spread on assists. We're getting steals, 7.3 steals per game, but we're also giving up steals, and we're blocking a lot of shots. We're sixth in the country in blocks, but we're turning the ball over too much, 15 times a game, and we're only forcing 12. So that's a really bad stat. Free throw shooting's actually been okay, 71%, which is right about median in the country. You know, Drew and Boogie are both averaging about 16 a game, but the difference is Drew is averaging, you know, 8 assists, 8 rebounds, but also 4 turnovers. Hopefully Trey White's shooting about 40% from the field, 41%. Reese has been stuck out because he's shooting only 30% from three, which is knocking his overall field goal percentage. He's below 40%. And, you know, Kobe Johnson's also at right around the same shooting percentage and is 0 for the season. I think he's 0 for 6 from 3, which, right. You know, not ideal. Okay, yeah. So here's how the tournament looks. It starts on Thursday. The game, I think, is 1 o'clock. Scheduled for 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, I should say. Pacific time, 3 o'clock Eastern time. Against BYU.
I think it's Wednesday, right?
Is it Wednesday?
It's a Wednesday through Friday.
Yeah. Oh, then I've okay. All right, I'm off on that. All right. So 3 o'clock. Okay. So 3 o'clock Wednesday against BYU. All right. That was a big mistake. Sorry about that, everyone. We're playing BYU. The game right after us, win or loser, it's a Tennessee Butler. So, you know, we play, depending on whether we win or lose, we play the winner or loser of that game. The top of the bracket is Kansas, North Carolina State, and then Dayton and Wisconsin. I would just hope for SC. I think we discussed this before. If we can sneak a win or two out of this tournament, that'd be wonderful. I think it's just, it's important for us, our guys, to see what, like, you know, what legitimate, you know, high major competition looks like, because I don't think they've really seen that yet.
Yeah, I think that BYU game feels like a toss-up. It's not a great BYU team, but, you know, then again, the way SC's play doesn't inspire a ton of confidence heading into that one either. If they do get that, I believe they get Tennessee right in round two, or it's the winner of Tennessee-Butler, I want to say. And, you know, presumably Tennessee will win that. And then that would, you know, be a very, very challenging game. If they do drop that game to BYU, though, I think you got to feel pretty good about their chances against Butler. So I think they will get one win out of the tournament. Getting two, though, I think is going to be pretty tough.
Yeah, I agree with that. Okay. As we're about to head into halftime here, what is it looking like? Kentucky's losing by 16 now to Gonzaga. 30 seconds left. All right. Anything else before we get out of here?
Do you want to dive into the Isaiah Collier?
Oh my goodness. How did I forget? Special request from David on our message board. Okay. So I think that the key thing to I actually think we need to back this up a little more to talk about the context here, because this is really like a two cycle of recruiting phenomenon where
right
Andy Enfield has offered a player that's potentially like outside of the normal geographical recruiting area that you would expect SC to be recruiting from last season. Vince Uwachukwu and Julian Phillips come to mind. Obviously Kajani Wright also applies, though, right? So
right.
There were various times, certainly with Kajani Wright, that we were being told as readers of the Bruin Report Online forum and from their site owner that UCLA was leading for these players. And as the recruiting process went on, and by the way, these were all players that had, you know, SC had built the fundamental connections with these players. Maybe that wasn't being disclosed at the time, but it was certainly the case with Kajani Wright and Vincent Uchukwu. To a lesser extent with Julian Phillips, because he never even visited UCLA, right? Or did he? I can't remember on that one, but
Yeah, if he did, they weren't really in serious consideration by the end of the process.
Yeah. And at various times you're hearing that, maybe not with Julian Phillips, but even for Uwuchukwu, that UCLA is favored to land these players. These are, and again, these are, this is Mick Cronin kind of drafting off of Andy Enfield's recruiting offers. And you started to see, as none of the players would end up committing to UCLA, and UCLA, look, they ended up with a great recruiting class. They have Dylan Andrews, obviously, but they also have Amari Bailey, and they end up with Adem Abona at their center position instead of Uwuchukwu, who might even be a better prospect.
Yeah, and let's make one note too on Kajani Wright. Like, it wasn't that UCLA was just recruiting him. Tracy Pearson wrote an entire like recruiting reset piece where Kajani Wright was at the he was the first name on the list, and the photo for the piece was a photo of Kajani Wright for the whole piece.
Right, and this was at a time where both of us had been told from reliable sources that Kajani Wright's going to USC. So it was this was not even like a. This was not like some like shocker that he might be interested in USC over UCLA. Like, if you were paying attention and you knew, that's, you know, that's where you thought he might go. So you started a narrative, then took hold that what was happening is none of the players that had previously been favoring UCLA and seemed like, you know, ideal targets for what they're looking for, it turns out they were not the right fit for the Mick Cronin program. And then later on, when it was kind of elaborated on what constituted the right fit was based upon whether or not they chose UCLA.
It's a self-selecting process.
So if a player chooses UCLA, he's the right fit. If he doesn't choose UCLA, then he's not the right fit. Which in the most reductive way imaginable is probably true, but also completely meaningless. So this is now carried over to like the Isaiah Collier situation is really hilarious, because I'm not even sure Isaiah Collier ever seriously considered going to UCLA. He and the USC coaches had been very, very tight. That relationship had been very, 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 very strong for more than a year now. And at some point in time, UCLA is being mentioned in the recruitment, very similar to the situation with Uwuchukwu and with Julian Phillips. Almost like, hey, USC is recruiting this guy. I think UCLA needs to recruit him as well. And at some point in time in the spring, again, this narrative starts that he's favoring UCLA, and UCLA is building its recruiting class around him, only to then find out later that he was not the right fit. So even though Mick Cronin attempted to quote unquote build his recruiting class around him, he apparently was mistaken, because the guy was not the right fit all along. But we only knew, we didn't find that out until he self-selected not to go to UCLA. Okay. So
not only that, but there was, you know, with his whole visit, like, people that, you know, knew kind of the details of his recruitment know that UCLA botched the visit, right? Like, it was a bad visit. He had a bad time. And like, of course, you're never going to get like an on the record quote about that. But then it was after that where, you know, the narrative on Bro was that UCLA had the lead after they botched the visit. So that just alone was unbelievable, right?
Right, which, and also makes you think, do they not know what's going on? Or does Mick Cronin not realize, and his staff not realize, that they're, you know, that this is how bad the situation is? Anyway, this entire idea that this is a self-selecting process, which has now been reiterated multiple times, and that that you can't determine whether or not a player is actually the proper fit for a recruit is not a, you can't determine whether or not a recruit is a proper fit for your program until the day he decides whether or not he's going to sign with you or commit to you. It's obviously there's a huge element of circular reasoning that goes behind this, and just kind of like insanity. So I will just say, I will say this. It's a little hard to reconcile the idea that all these players are self-selecting and there's not the right fit, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, when UCLA loses these two games in the Vegas tournament, and it appears that there is a talent deficit, at least in the Illinois game, or athleticism deficit in the Illinois game. If it's truly the case that this is all about having some very kind of like esoteric fit that needs to be made with Mick Cronin, that's a really poor sign that UCLA is now not winning these games. You would expect, oh, this is like you're you know, it's like it's almost like you're figuring out the jigsaw puzzle and the pieces just fit perfectly together, but they're losing anyway. So, and we talked about it at the beginning of the podcast. Like, I think it's probably now baked to the cake that UCLA will not be getting one and dones for the, near term. I mean, I guess that could change if they bring in some like AAU like ringer as an assistant coach. But for now, that doesn't look like it's been the right match as far as what they talk about not being a fit. One and dones going to UCLA is not a fit. So I don't know. I exhausted my thoughts on this, but what do you have anything to add?
Let me just and one of our mutual friends here texted us a few quotes about from the Isaiah Collier camp about the UCLA kind of the way they recruited him. So let me read some
Yeah,
of
this is
this
from a
here, and
Sports Illustrated article that came out like a week before Collier announced.
And at this point, he basically publicly cut UCLA from this list. So here's what Isaiah said about UCLA, and I think some SC fans will get a kick out of this. He said it was cool to see the style in official practice. They get up and down like I like, so I feel I would be able to have success in that system. End quote. The prevailing issue around the table with UCLA is the reassuring examples of former players like Isaiah who have had success, like Russell Westbrook. Who most compare Isaiah to? I don't compare him to Russell Westbrook, but anyway, Darren Collison and Lonzo Ball, who I think Isaiah is somewhat similar to, weren't with Mick Cronin's staff. On the basketball side, Mick Cronin didn't play a freshman a whole lot at Cincinnati, and he liked to control the game by calling a lot of sets. It's absolutely true. Now that could be because of a lack of personnel, but it's something we certainly have to look at. Isaiah was perplexed as to why the staff consistently plays up the Bruins' 11 national titles, the last of which came in 1995, 5 coaching staffs ago, and 9 years before he was born. It's been a while, Isaiah says, before cutting his next sentence short. I mean, if it was recent, dot, dot, dot. And then, this guy, Dwayne, I think he might be a handler or something or some guy tied in. He said, these kids don't know those people. We may give a school credit for what they've done in the past, but teenagers don't think like that. Chandra agrees the pitch in Westwood's a little out of touch, but in true fashion was qu quick to praise the educational aspect. So pretty interesting that you're seeing some of that stuff on the record about the UCLA pitch, but I mean, it makes sense, right? Like, if you're a 17 or 18-year-old kid, like, why would you care about what happened in 1960 to 2000, right?
Well, so yeah, so let me two thoughts leap to mind. First off, on 1995, because I was around then and I know all about it, that was the only title UCLA has won by during my lifetime. And I was born in 1976. So all the other titles before 1995, it wasn't like, oh, those were 1992 and 1989. No, those were back in the mid-60s to the mid-70s. At a very, very different time of college basketball. So much so that there's not even a ton of surviving video from those eras. So we're talking about like one title in the last whatever 48 years. Okay. In addition to that, and this is I think where there's a genuine issue UCLA needs to kind of like reconcile. It's not like UCLA hasn't had broader success. They were in a Final Four with Mick Cronin a couple of years back. They were in three consecutive Final Fours with Ben Howland. The problem is the essentially the kind of basketball administration fan base will not tolerate the recognition of these other Final Four teams. So it makes it seem like they haven't, there's nothing has happened. Nothing has happened in the last 25 years. And there's only one thing has happened in the last 50, when in reality, they've actually been good. They just haven't been at the level that they used to be. Yeah. So I think they need to be playing that up, which they can very easily do, but it will require them hanging other banners in Pauly that are not national championship banners. And yeah, I mean, look, the ghost of John, there is no greater detriment to success for a program than nostalgia. Nostalgia is always, always a negative. Prospectively, nostalgia is always a negative. You see with USC football repeatedly. I can't tell you how often leading up into the Pete Carroll era in football, how you just heard as a drumbeat that we needed to, you know, get back to running student body right and student body left. When in reality, student body left and student body right had been killed off in the early 80s when USC took a played Florida, I think, at a conference game and just got manhandled because the defensive end was so fast that he got to the backside defensive end was able to get to the running back and knock him down. Now, after the Pete Carroll era, you heard a lot of the same. We need to get back to the Pete Carroll era. No, you need to look forward, not backwards. So thank God in football, we have Lincoln Riley because he's actually living in the present and to an extent in the future. You know, the looking back thing, I mean, just I could go on and on about this, but let's just talk about what basketball was like when John Wooden was the coach of UCLA. There were virtually no substitutions the entire game. The starting five played almost the entire game, all five players. You might see one guy take a break here and there. There might be a break for foul trouble, but it was very little, very, very, very little in the way of substituting. Coaches didn't call timeouts. If there was timeouts were very rarely used to break momentum. They were not used strategically at end of games. So a lot of the end of game scenarios that we see today where teams blow, you know, leads at the end of games because of, kind of fouling and timeouts, that didn't really happen. There was fouling, although not to the same extent that there is now. And certainly there was not strategic use of timeouts. There was no 3-point line. That's rather obvious. And that's a huge equalizer for certain programs. And then, of course, when it comes to the actual playing of the tournaments. So for 9 of the 10 tournaments that John Wooden won, the structure was this. UCLA, all the regions were divided geographically, and essentially conference winners were the only ones invited. There were no at-large bids. You might make it in as an independent. There might be a couple slots for independents, but generally speaking, you were only going to be playing conference winners. So UCLA, in order to get to the Final Four, basically had to defeat what was then the equivalent of a Big West school, often like a Long Beach State, or a West Coast Conference school, maybe San Francisco, and then beat, at the time, a WAC school like Arizona State or Utah. And they were into the Final Four. That's all they had to do. They had to win 2 games, and they were going to be playing mid-majors in those what were at the time mid-majors to get into that Final Four. Now, they won the Final Four when they got there. Of course, a disproportionate amount of those were actually played in Los Angeles or San Diego area. Some were playing in Kansas City. But UCLA is making the Final Four by winning 2 games against what are effectively mid-majors. It was not until their last national championship under Wooden where UCLA had to beat any at-large teams. Now, of course, today's game, most of the teams that make the Final Four, win the championship, most teams that win games are at large. They're not conference winners. So we're talking about a completely different era of basketball. And for UCLA to still be like so fixated on that, to me, is just completely insane. But I'm not a Bruin. So anyway, just laying that all out there and stuff to think about. And if you were in the Final Four a couple of years ago, yeah, I'd be publicizing that. I mean, it's probably the best marketing the basketball. That game with Jalen Suggs hitting the 50-footer to beat you in overtime. I mean, that is one of the most iconic basketball games in recent memory, and people should be remembering that. And I guess UCLA instead wants people to remember what happened in 1967.
Yeah, one other comment too. Like, I know UCLA fans have been frustrated about their lack of NIL, and I don't think that USC's NIL is perfect by any stretch. I think, especially in football, you're seeing it, right? Like, I think they're behind some of these other schools, certainly behind A&M and Miami, and lots of these other SEC schools. I think their football class is ranked like 13th, and it's kind of ironic that USC's basketball class is ranked ahead of the football class, despite the football team, being, pretty much a top five team, right? So there are issues there, but I think it does say something about USC's NIL a little bit. Just the fact they've been able to build out this top 10 class, I think that's a decent sign. And one other kind of like side note I'll make, it's kind of ironic that, Mick Cronin's, followed Andy Enfield around in his evaluations on these players. And the one kid he didn't really, use that strategy was Silas Demery. And Silas Demery would be a killer player at UCLA as like a 4-year guard. So I think that's just kind of interesting too.
Yeah, it is interesting. Although maybe they thought because of Dylan Andrews, they didn't want to go after him. I don't know. That's interesting to
Well,
think about.
Dylan Andrews scared off Isaiah Collier, right?
Right,
Like
that's true. He
they
probably for sure scared off Silas Demery. Okay, all right. I think that's going to be it. We'll wrap it up there. And if we don't hear from us, I hope everyone has a wonderful Thanksgiving. And if you can, watch USC on around the Thanksgiving holidays. So fight on, everyone.
Yeah, fight on.